Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
It is always a very great pleasure when you are able to work with somebody who complements your work in significant ways. I am without Professor Stephen Misha's guidance, the ROFG would falter, and, you know, he's also quite equally responsible for the conference. Please. This is the first Mbanefo Foundation Conference on Modern and Contemporary African Art. At the meeting of the Center for Black Studies last week, Professor Claudine Michel, the director of the Center for Black Studies, Claudine, please take a bow, informed me that this is actually the first conference on this campus devoted to this subject of modern and contemporary African art. So I did not know that when we started, and that certainly wasn't the intention. The intention was to provide a forum for discussing some important topics that have emerged in our field of study, and this forum was made possible by the generous support of the Mbanefo Foundation, whose trustee, Mr. Arthur Mbanefo, is seated here in front. The Mbanefo Foundation provided the total funding for this conference, which is quite unprecedented in most of these kinds of activities. What we are gathered here to do, therefore, today is to evaluate the beginning of a new discourse on modern and contemporary African art at UCSB, which locates this university as a significant position and location in the, you know, discourse of African art and culture in general. This is something that's been growing recently and is quite significant. I'm going to hand over the microphone to Stephen Misha so he can introduce the chair of the Department of History of Art and Architecture. And before I say that, let me thank my students in the ARUTH 121D class who are here today. They have kindly agreed to, you know, sit in on this class. I did a little arm twisting, but you're all welcome. So, Stephen.
Yeah. So please let me welcome and call to the podium Professor Peter Sturman, who is, as Sylvester said, the chair of the Department of History of Art and Architecture. Thank you.
Thank you. I didn't prepare any remarks specifically. I thought I would just speak informally and welcome everyone, first of all, coming from across the country and from across the ocean. It's a great thing when so many people can come to Santa Barbara from so far away to bring your talents together and to put your minds together and create something new. I want to thank three people and institutions specifically. First of all, the IHC. Those of you who are not so familiar with our campus should know that the Interdisciplinary Humanities Center is a great resource on this campus and has been taken advantage of many times by people in our department, including myself about 15 years ago when I ran a conference on mountains in China. And their support and guidance and leadership has been fundamental, I think, to helping define much of the identity of UCSB's humanities and fine arts. Secondly, I'd like to thank Mr. Mbanefo. I think we all realize that without the generous support of interested people from the outside who are interested in seeing the endeavors of the talents that we have here in our institution flourish, it's very difficult to reach our full potential. And I think with that, the third person I'd like to thank is Sylvester. I've known Sylvester now since he arrived, actually before he arrived at UCSB. I helped recruit him, and I can say with absolute confidence that I've never known a person with more energy and more talent and more intellectual rigor than Sylvester. And the proof of that is this great constellation of people that we have here today. I'd like to now introduce the leader of the Humanities and Fine Arts, Dean David Marshall.
Thank you. I'm not usually introduced as the leader. Might give me some kind of delusions. So, well, I'm very glad to be here just to offer my welcome to all of you who have come from out of town and those who have come from across campus. I met some of you last night. We are very proud of this conference, and we hope that it's going to inaugurate a lot of other events, not only conferences, but the type of interdisciplinary inquiry across the humanities and the arts and the social sciences and many other areas that this campus is known for. So we're grateful to the Mabanefo Foundation for its support and the IHC, which really has this wonderful program of research focus groups, which bring together faculty from across the campus, students, and then build upon the activities to create efforts like this as well. Last night at dinner, we were having a lively conversation about the problem of literacy in the world today, and I was making some disparaging remarks about Wikipedia and how students learn and where they get their information from. And as I was thinking about encyclopedias afterwards, I remembered, in fact, years ago when I read the entry on Africa in the famous 1911 Encyclopedia Britannica. As some of you know, the 1911 11th edition was really the kind of authoritative pronouncement of the sum of knowledge of the world, and in a way, still at the beginning of the 20th century, really kind of announced a kind of, not exactly an agenda, but a sort of a crucial perspective that was in some ways still a 19th century perspective, yet sort of defining what was going to be a very changed century. And I don't know how many people here have actually read that entry on Africa. It's really fascinating. But I began to think about what it means to be almost 100 years after that in a conference that's thinking about modernity and global identities in such interesting ways. It begins by talking a lot about geography. It's written by the librarian to the Royal Geographical Society in London. And it says there are three things that you really need to know about Africa. One is that there are no sharp divisions to mark the extent of the various races composing the population, that the number of what may be termed transnational people is unusually large. And then the most important point that's devoted the most amount of sentences is this: Africa, with the exception of the Lower Nile Valley and what is known as Roman Africa, is, so far as its native inhabitants are concerned, a continent practically without a history and possessing no records from which such a history could be reconstructed. And it goes on to say some rather startling things about how the people there are basically children of the moment with no memory. And then the third point it makes is, well, we have to admit that a lot of this is really just conjecture because so little is known about this continent, which maybe should have been the first and the only point that they made at the beginning of this long article. But it struck me that this was, you know, this seems, of course, you know, shocking in a way, even, you know, looking back to 1911. But almost, you know, 100 years later, we know, of course, that there are many histories in Africa and in other places. But the question of modernity, as we are entering the 21st century, is really crucial. And the question of how culture and identity are defined in a global society really reframes a whole set of issues in sort of startlingly new ways. And studying art, I think, in this context is really important because it allows us to ask many of the questions, not answer, but to ask many of the questions that are posed by this conference. It's, you know, there's a famous adage that history is a story written by the winners. Well, art is in some ways the kind of battlefield, but also the site of negotiation for, I think, all of the issues at play in thinking about modernity, cultural politics, and global identity. So I think it's a really very, very productive way to focus these issues. We're very impressed by the array of talent that have come here to participate in this conference, and I look forward to eventually reading some of the papers and the investigations that come out of it. So thank you very much. We appreciate it, and we hope that you have a productive conference. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dean Marshall, for that very kind and wonderful introduction. I would like now to introduce the trustee of the Mbanefo Foundation, Mr. Art Mbanefo, please.
Distinguished ladies and gentlemen, friends of Africa, friends of the arts, I can't tell you how excited I am to be here today among such an impressive group of academics and professionals. I'm indebted to the University of California here in beautiful Santa Barbara for supporting the dream of a young man from Nigeria. When I first discussed the concept of a foundation based around contemporary African art with Dr. Sylvester Ogbeche back in 2003, he was probably the only person that I spoke to that actually bought into the vision I had. I had a number of conversations. The university, like any business, has many choices to evaluate. The fact that they were supportive of collaborating with Sylvester and I was thoroughly refreshing. The Dean of Humanities, David Marshall, Leslie Gray, and the rest of the people here in Santa Barbara have made this possible, along with distinguished panelists and presenters, and I'm indebted to you all. I'm in awe, and I really probably should not deserve to be up here addressing any of you, because I'm probably the person with the least amount of knowledge about the subjects which we'll be discussing over the next couple of days. I remember visiting Lagos from boarding school in 1982 and meeting a young Hank Drewell, who was cataloging Dad's collection at the time. I had bought my first piece, a Kikuyu carving, on a family vacation in Kenya in 1979, and I wondered why one would need a list of all the work. I decided to catalog my 6 or 7 pieces, clearly inaccurately. And I just look at that, and we're talking about 100 years, I look at, 25 years ago, Dr. Drewell is a big name in the space today. I'm happy to be able to say I knew him when. Personally, I can trace my lineage back 15 generations from my father's side to Odimegwu Boagu and Onitsha District Eze in the 17th century, and back to 1066 and a consort of William the Conqueror on my maternal grandmother's. I have Muslim cousins and I have Scottish cousins. I have Arab relatives and Asian relatives, and they are all African. Growing up in Nigeria, it was instilled in me at an early age that each of us on this earth is a custodian of our customs, and all of us belong to Africa, and she too belongs to us. The difficulty I often face today is representing to many scholars, collectors, and lovers of the arts that so many facets exist in the arts, all of which need to be acknowledged. Art for many of us is aesthetic, and for the rest is evolving life. Visual arts, sound and music, textiles and literature, religion and spirituality, politics, gender, sexuality. You name it, with more tongues, complexions, customs, races, and tribes than just about anywhere else on earth, she continues to evolve. In the words of Plato, something new always comes out of Africa. African art for so long has been thought of in the tribal sense only. I sit on the advisory board for the Smithsonian Institute, and we've struggled, but over the last couple of years, have opened up more to contemporary art. Spirituality and daily activities are explored by non-Africans, sometimes not necessarily grasping the deep meaning of the work. Contemporary arts then suddenly jump into photography. And I acknowledge here the work of Okwuegwuazo, my friend, which he achieved in a short century. Many of us have the same photographs at home in our parents' collections, and were amazed that they fetched so much money today. Another approach, and a very thoughtful one at that, has been represented by Lala Esaidi, offering a refreshing base to open a dialogue on women's involvement in the arts of Africa. The 1960s was a period of hope, expression, a period of change, a period of newness, setting the stage for where we are today. I look forward to the day when my three young children can explain, as modern-day Americans, New Yorkers for that matter, the depth and breadth of their roots in the arts of Africa, from the flow of the Ijele masquerade and the bronze anklets of their ancestor Mbanefa Odu I, to great-uncle Benewamu's tutu, some of the phenomenal work being done today by protégés of Bruce Onabrakpeya. I look for increased inclusion between the arts of the Arab regions and those of the Sahel and the Sub-Sahara, from henna to Ashanti gold, and from the intricacies of the mosques of the north to the Ndebele designs of the kraal walls of the south. Our art has so much political history that we should share this further and all learn from it. Today, African art shows the realities of life on a continent that evolves with different influences and pressures. My late grandfather, Mbanefa Odu II of Onitsha, often used to sit with me and talk about the family's history and my future responsibilities. I see this first conference here in Santa Barbara as validation to conversations of over 20 years ago and the beginning of something that is vitally needed within African art. I'd like to share two gems of knowledge from the Odu II, who died aged 96 in 1994. The first was about the fact that Unilever, large Dutch concern, like many European companies in the post-colonial era, bought and kept properties in Nigeria, houses, you know, offices, things like that, in the hope of making a financial killing as the country went through development. Nigeria's independence was October the 1st, 1960. Well, two little problems. First of all, we had a little civil war. And that created a little slowdown in the development process. But secondly, was something more important. Africans do not sell their homes. It was the same thing in the UK until probably the 70s. You bought the home, it got passed through the family, you stayed in the home. Some people had their bodies buried in the backyard. You don't sell the house. That's very important because that's what's happening in arts today. People buy African art and they don't ever sell it, so there's technically no secondary market for it. One of the goals of my foundation is working with organizations to create a secondary market through broader awareness and an increased interest in the arts. The second gem is probably quite timely, as Nigeria just had its elections 2 weeks ago. Clearly, there's quite a bit of unrest around those. My grandfather and I were talking during the Nigerian gubernatorial, so governor's elections of 1992, and he was remarking on progress. He told me that in the late 1950s, pre-independence, some questionable candidates would often attempt to induce voters online when they're registering to vote on their behalf by offering them cans of sardines. So he asked me, he said, today, it was in 1992, dubious candidates were handing out 20 naira bills, Nigerian currency, like a $20 bill at the time, if you vote for them. He asked me, he said, do you know how much a can of sardines cost? Well, I was working in London at the time, I didn't have a clue. His answer, 20 naira, so much for progress. Unfortunately, I cannot stay for the entire conference, as both my sons make their first communion tomorrow morning back in New York, so I'll be on a plane back. Don't want to miss that. But through Sylvester, I'm always available, with some notice, to pursue further dialogue on this subject, which is clearly dear to me. I should add that my father, Mbanefa Odu III, wanted to also attend the conference. He's 77. But I convinced him that it was quite a long trip and that we're planning to sort of, I think the foundation is considering trying to work on having an exhibition of some of our artwork here. We have over 300 paintings, about over 400 or 500 artifacts, sometime later on in the year or into next year, and that would be the ideal thing for him to come out, do a little bit of spa, enjoy the beach a bit, you know, and make it a long trip. He started the art collection with my grandfather, and I owe him the debt of gratitude for spurring my interest at an early age. I grew up listening to a lot of jazz, seen a lot of artwork, and every Christmas having to listen to every platter of Handel's Messiah. Enjoy the dialogue, and I remind you all that we're all Africans, and she and her arts belong to each and every one of us, and it's only up to us to preserve them. Again, thank you for making this a reality for me.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mbanefo. Mr. Mbanefo probably underplays the tremendous impact he's had in several other areas. He's a financial titan on Wall Street, having worked in the financial world for quite a considerable amount of time. He was at one point one of the highest-ranked investors with Credit Suisse First Boston, and he runs his own financial establishment today. We are going to take about 5 minutes to reorganize the program of the conference. But before we do that, I want to make a few statements on the logistics of our event here today. For the students who are here on a sign-in process, the first panel is lasting from 9:45, 9:50 to about 11:30 or thereabouts. We'd be grateful if you persist for the duration of that first panel. Secondly, about the conference in general, about the whole issue of modern and contemporary African art, of which we'll be speaking about a lot more today, I want to point out that there is something very important that we should also bear in mind, that the nature of scholarship in this field is something that is evolving tremendously at a very fast pace. In the past 10 or 15 years, there have been a lot of developments in the field which have actually had major consequences. There is only an expectation that these developments will grow. But what we are hoping to institute here is a critical foundation for further analysis, which then becomes quite a unique way to look at the problems of the present, because we want to subject our exegesis to much more critical evaluation in order to determine exactly what the foundations and structures of our field are. So in many ways, this conference is a groundbreaking event, which we hope will, you know, spur quite a lot of different events as the time goes by. I hope to have another of these conferences next year, but we'll be talking about that as we unfold the program. Please give us 5 minutes to rearrange our program. We'll be back with you in a few minutes.
Museum of Art. Previously, she has worked at the Smithsonian. She has done extensive fieldwork in Senegal, West Africa, and is now working also in North Africa on research and exhibition projects. And her presentation today is Heritage Comes from the Past, Cultural Policy, Rhetoric, and the Problem of Contemporary Arts in Francophone Africa. So please let us welcome Kinsey.
Is this okay? Okay, thank you. Very happy to be here, and glad that... Oh, thank you. Is there some place else to put it?
Let me get you a small cup of water.
Okay. Okay.
Take your first slide so we can see how good it looks.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you to UCSB and to Sylvester for organizing this. It comes at a particularly useful time for me because in the last year or so, I've been reflecting back on the work that I've been doing for the last 10 or 12 years and thinking about things in a different way. And this is the first forum I've really had to think about it and talk to it in more detail. And a smaller forum is more conducive to that because there are few enough of us that we can actually talk about it. And I'm hoping to get some feedback. So I don't really draw neat conclusions at the end with the express intention of hoping that, you know, we have a chance to discuss some things that I bring up. So in this paper, I consider the critical role of African cultural policies in shaping the institutional, ideological, and philosophical frameworks within which modern and contemporary African arts have been created and exhibited. To do so, I problematize the paradigmatic oppositions that structure the distinction between tradition and heritage, on the one hand, and modern and contemporary art as articulated by policy rhetoric in Africa and implemented in museum and other exhibitionary frameworks since the colonial period. And a quick note on terminology. For the purposes of this paper, I may use tradition, heritage, authenticity somewhat interchangeably on the one hand, and then modern and contemporary, largely because that's in keeping with the way the rhetoric is articulated in policy documents that I was working with. And not to say that those aren't debatable terms, but for this, I want to not get bogged down in the terms and talk about some other issues. So as a point of departure, I focus on the West African country of Senegal, whereas in many other African nations, governing administrations have emphasized both cultural heritage and modern and contemporary arts. And here I focus primarily on cultural institutions in Dakar, the capital city of Senegal, because these demonstrate convergent issues of nationalism, globalization, and representation. The institutions embody modernity as defined as the images and institutions associated with progress and development in the contemporary world. And this is a definition offered by Bruce Nauft in a book called Critically Modern. And though museums constitute an essential component of this research, my intention here is not to critique the institutions and the policies that address national heritage. That's something that I and other scholars have undertaken elsewhere. Instead, I interrogate the more fundamental underpinnings that structure policies' inherent contradictions, exclusions, and ideologies. And to do this, I turn to literature exploring culturally specific concepts of time. When considered in the context of nationalist discourse, this body of literature provides a useful frame for understanding the disjuncture between tradition and modernity, and also between international and international dynamics of Senegalese cultural policy, while also resonating with related discourse in postcolonial states worldwide. This line of inquiry has emerged during the course of fieldwork in Dakar since 1995 and 1996, and at the outset, my research focused on three more or less separate trajectories: the state as purveyor of national identity through museum exhibition practice, political rhetoric addressing arts and heritage, and contemporary visual arts in the urban environment. And where nationalist discourse is concerned, two distinct aspects recur. One, government cultural heritage policy and rhetoric invoking a traditional historical past, and two, national policy supporting the development of modern art in an independent state. The capital city, Dakar, provides a very salient site for this topic because of its long history of government-sponsored art initiatives dating back to the colonial period. As the administrative center of French West Africa, it was the point from which arts and cultural heritage policy was disseminated. Where do I need to point this, Stephen? I'll just click. With the growing collections assembled in the 19th and 20th centuries, exhibition of those objects collected by French expeditions became an important priority both in France and in the colonies. Museums in each regional center in West Africa exhibit traditional masks and sculpture from throughout Francophone Africa. The intent here was to preserve a heritage and a disappearing past and educate the local people about what was being lost. And this is especially important in Iranic and French West Africa because cultural tradition and expression were specifically targeted for change. The static image of traditional arts and culture presented in these exhibitions posed a stark contrast to new art forms produced by artists trained in the Beaux-Arts tradition, whose work embodied the dynamic modernization initiated through European contact. So contemporary arts figured into policy beginning in the colonial period when the French colonial administration established a fine arts school in Dakar. And exhibitions of traditional art at the IFON in the museum and were intended as sources of inspiration for the fine art students' work. IFON is museum of the Institut Fondamental d'Afrique Noire. So it was a broad-based educational mission which organized French scholars to go on these expeditions to collect information to educate the French and indigenous publics. While the colonial and independent administrations were both committed to political and economic change, where culture was concerned, there's an overarching theme of preservation, recalling the precedent set during the colonial period. And following independence in 1960, the Senegalese state inherited the Ifan Museum and its collection of West African objects from the colonial administration. This is the original building in the of the museum and the one where it remains today. The collection in the independent nation was reinterpreted by the independent state to invoke a lost heritage and to affirm a nascent nationalist identity rooted in idealized, ahistorical, and largely undifferentiated African past. The government, under the auspices of President Leopold Senghor, who's well known for his strident support of the arts, presumed that pre-colonial works of art represented the authentic heritage necessary to achieving a desirable future. This is articulated very clearly in a 1973 policy document. Exhibitions of such traditional art forms were said to illustrate traditional lifestyle lost to the chosen path of civilization and progress. And to this end, the Ifan collection that had been dispersed throughout the colonial centers in West Africa was centralized at the National Museum of Dakar. In this context, heritage connotes an authentic past that is pre-colonial, widely shared, and largely imaginary. While the government cultivated a unified Senegalese community through preservationist policy, it also announced a new national identity through the development of modern fine arts. Building on the structures put in place by the colonial administration, Senghor established the foundation for ongoing state support of the arts and culture and created multiple forums for modern artists trained in fine art schools in Dakar and abroad. And some of the work I show here without going into detail. Work by these contemporary artists was perceived to embody the modernization process. In shows such as Art Sénégalais d'aujourd'hui, Senegalese Art Today, and Contemporary Art of Senegal in the 1970s, correlated with the young nation's aim to establish itself as an autonomous player in the international arena. They featured the work of Senegalese artists, most of whom were trained in the Beaux-Arts tradition, largely painting. This is a tapestry that was designed by a Senegalese artist and created at a tapestry factory outside of Dakar. These exhibitions were intended to forge and proclaim a national identity for the nascent state in a global arena, one based on ideals of modernization while also maintaining respect for the past. Contemporary paintings executed in Western media testified to the modernity of the Senegalese culture, purportedly with the intention of dispelling the widely conceived myth of African primitivism among Westerners. The artists were deliberately identified as Senegalese, and their work was part of a nationalist development strategy in which policy and the arts played a prominent role. And this is a gallery at the museum, at the Ifan Museum in the 1990s. So, in the independent era, which is post-1960, the emphasis by the Senegalese state is on both disappearing heritage on the one hand and also westernized contemporary culture on the other, which remains recognizable today. And Senghor's cultural policy remains an important historical referent, even though he left office in 1980. In Senegal and throughout Africa, policy has iterated the preservation of historic, tradition-based art forms in their exhibition. And state rhetoric does advocate the development of contemporary arts, but it's not in the context of heritage discourse. Instead, creative expression in the Beaux-Arts tradition is what constitutes visual expression and excludes diverse art forms throughout the city. And they're very deliberate in their agenda here, and it's through this infrastructure that the state positions itself as arbiter of the arts, culture, and heritage. The state is not the only purveyor of cultural policy and support for the arts, however, and this is something that became very clear once I actually got to the field for the first time. In recent years, international entities have supported cultural initiatives, working directly with local populations rather than through state structures. More concerned with grassroots development, these programs illustrate alternative strategies for more inclusive heritage policy. And I refer here to one such entity, the West African Ecopole Museum, pictured here. Based in Dakar, the Ecopole was established in 1996 as a forum for local and regional communities. It's located in Dakar's impoverished ex-industrial district, where there are lots of mechanics yards and other working districts. Ecopole programs engage underrepresented local residents, such as transient newcomers, homeless children, and women domestic workers. At Ecopole, urban communities' inherent resourcefulness frames conceptions of present and future heritage. At its inception and for several years, the exhibition Ingenieuse Afrique, Ingenious Africa, was the cornerstone of the museum and embodied its fundamental principles. The exhibition has toured internationally, much like the government-sponsored exhibitions of the 1960s and 1970s, though with a different missive. It's comprised of objects made from throughout Africa, from recycled materials such as wire, scrap metal, and other discards. The exhibition articulates two essential ideas, the universality and continuity of recycling phenomena, and the importance of recycling in contemporary African experience. The materials used indicate the links between local creative production and global influences. There's Coca-Cola imagery that invokes ties to American and global consumption patterns, while articles made from misprinted albacore tuna cans, such as this, with multilingual script invoke French and Portuguese influence in the region. And these objects are all things that are also constructed on site in workshops where artists and artisans work with young students and apprentices. It's interesting to note that this exhibition doesn't present objects as purely or even primarily aesthetic, offered to viewers to interpret with little guidance. On the contrary, its relevance to contemporary economic and environmental concerns is made very explicit. Indeed, such choices in repertoire and style are ideologically charged, and they attempt to bring these forms and to the people creating them into the European hierarchy of artistic expression. In this context, museum programs highlight Africans' propensity for recuperation, especially the capacity to integrate diverse materials and cultures. Shared experience and symbols provide viewers with direct access to objects displayed. For example, here we have lamps made from the discarded cans from a local mosquito repellent. Yotox is yoy is mosquito, and tox obviously is toxic. And so they're ubiquitous in the can form, and then they have the second life in the lamps. And at the same time, this dovetails with the Ecopole's health education programs. Such readily recognizable forms mediate between self and other without denying the diversity and concurrency of local, regional, and global identities. They validate urban experience and provide opportunities for economic development. However, in this case, the nation state's no longer a prerequisite for the economic development, civic education, and cosmopolitan identities associated with modernity. Administered by a development organization, it's not attached to the state in any way. And by bypassing these state structures, it's not limited by the constraints of national heritage discourse or the conventional economic strategies of modernization. Instead, the museum provides access to larger regional and global economic networks and heritage discourse while valorizing the creative capacity of local residents. In doing so, Ecopole essentially democratizes the museum concept, bringing local experience into the fold through the legitimating structure of the museum and locating it in a Western hierarchy. Instead, Ecopole and ENDA rhetoric locates contemporary creative expression in an ongoing heritage, one that's taking place at present and in the future, and one that derives from the diverse population's experience rather than one that is disseminated by the state. Ingenieuse Afrique and the Ecopole then provide a counterpoint to culture represented in state-sponsored initiatives and create an alternative conception of heritage, art, culture, and history that incorporates urban experience. When comparing these two concepts of heritage at the IFON and at the Ecopole, each clearly has different sensibilities. Following independence, art institutions in Senegal were designed to promote a new nationalist community identity. At IFON, abstract historical conceptions of heritage predominate, and cultural adaptation correlates with cultural extinction. Where modern art is concerned, the community to which the state refers is a national one positioned within an international system. but it doesn't really accommodate the variety of different communities within the Senegalese public itself. In addition, where state rhetoric perceives modern art as rupture, the Equipol recognizes contemporary creative expression as innovation rather than loss. Ingénieuse Afrique and the Equipol respond to the vanishing heritage paradigm, presenting urban creativity as continuity rather than rupture. And the history of modernity has always been pluralized by these disruptions and recounted in the register of a counter-modernity where different memories are reconstituted, telling the stories of the silenced or the marginalized whose experience of modernity has and continues to be more profoundly ambivalent. Indisputably, colonial experience has substantially influenced development of heritage in the arts, but to say that it extinguished a culture is defeatist, and it denies local dynamism and agency, when in fact people transform existing forms as they draw on an ever-expanding repertoire, and they always have. Viewed from this perspective, tradition and modernity are conflated, and the oppositional paradigm between the two is destabilized. So this off-sided and much maligned dichotomy is not merely a conceptual matter, though we discuss it a lot from that point of view. Where creative expression and cultural policy are concerned, it's a distinctly practical matter as well. One interview in particular illustrated the way that this is manifested in cultural policy in Senegal. And on this occasion, a highly placed government official, thank you, in the Ministry of Culture informed me that between heritage and contemporary urban expression, and I quote, there is an inherent contradiction. Cultural heritage comes from the past. He further dissociated the two realms by adding that heritage is not a part of contemporary experience and it must be protected from it. So there's this perceived opposition that may have originated under the colonial administration, but it's had ongoing effect to this day. In the section I have entitled Appropriate Time Constraints, because I'm running out of time, I'll say that even though scholars have kind of discounted this idea of an authentic past, policymakers have not been inclined to do so. And one way I've been thinking about this to kind of parse this disjuncture between contemporary arts and heritage policy discourse, I turn to literature exploring culturally specific concepts of time. Which many scholars associate with representation, especially in the face of received enlightenment values. So here I am suggesting that the assumptions of enlightenment-based thought, in which history is perceived as linear and qualitatively progressive, informs nationalist administrative cultural policies in creative communities. But that denies a sense of process and agency that really allows for transformation. The same scholars that have theorized agency and practice are among those that have talked about culturally diverse conceptions of time. And Fabian, for example, on Time and the Other, outlines the origins of a linear history that coincide with industrialization and imperial expansion and fascination with natural history. And there are two different kinds of time that scholars have talked about. One is monumental time, which refers to history in its greatest scope, reaching into the past back to antiquity and beyond, and ending before a very ambiguous present. And it's marked by established historical events and other completed actions. This is the time of the nation state. It's one that the European powers brought in with colonialism and established, but has become integral to the existing administrative structures and cultures. And as many scholars have suggested, Benedict Anderson, for example, national museums and state-sponsored exhibitions have been complicit in nation-building, and they create temporarily unreal environments imposing an arrested time of aesthetic contemplation. And within galleries of African art, one often finds a certain unity in one that echoes that declared by the government. In the statement by the official above, there's a marked distinction he makes between contemporary and heritage. Now, this is something that's very clearly different from the rhetoric at the Equipol, where present-day experience is considered not only part of heritage, but central to it and constitutive of it. And so in this way, it valorizes what people are doing in the present day. And I'm going to skip to my conclusions, and I can go into this more in discussion. The the things that come to mind is, one, if heritage is what valorizes and validates identity in people's lives, as the government articulates with respect to this authentic past, then I wonder whether continuing support for contemporary arts as separate from Senegalese, separate from heritage, if in this case the Senegalese state is undermining the legitimacy of the citizenry as viable participants in the nation's national system. And a second point is, one scholar made a statement that riveted my attention. She says, you know, we are all to some extent historically determined by the Enlightenment, which I think is a fair assessment, though I think we need to consider the various ways in which our experiences are defined by it. And this, a forum such as this is one way of getting at that. But in any case, the engagement of individuals with modernity and global processes is also an engagement with and reclamation of history and constitutes a source of empowerment that undermines nationalist narratives. And this is from a book called Other Histories by Kirsten Hastrup. It's an excellent volume, 1992. But I wonder, is it possible that individual engagement with modernity and globalization or that of more localized communities need not necessarily undermine nationalist narratives? We've all at one time or another asserted that cultures themselves and traditions are not static, and so it seems that it should follow then that national institutions, which are equally cultural constructions, also have the capacity to transform. So ultimately, what I'd like to do is get beyond, if not dispense with, this reifying language that I feel like we are forced to work with. And I'm not sure that I've done that today, but I'd like to continue thinking along these lines and find a way of accommodating a more inclusive vocabulary, or at least use the same vocabulary without contingent value judgments. So any comments would be greatly appreciated. Thanks so much.
Not have our first speaker on the program, Francis Ugyomor. Unfortunately, due to logistical problems, could not be here. So actually, in this panel, we are making up with time, and since we have a dense program, that's perhaps good. So we will have a discussion after the two speakers, so let me introduce you our second speaker, Stephen Wooten, who works in the Department of Anthropology at the University of Oregon. He has done extensive fieldwork in rural areas of Mali for more than a decade, and his paper today is called The Power of Kibara is Awesome, How Traditional Bamana Culture Becomes Modern. So let us please welcome Stephen Wooten.
I hope you can hear me okay. All right. Chiwara, literally farming animal in the Bamana language of West Africa. It means several things, and I want to try to tease apart some of those in the first few minutes, and then what I want to do is extend those basic comments into looking at some manifestations of Chiwara beyond the Malian kind of context. So on the Mandé Plateau in central Mali, people use the term Chiwara in several different kinds of ways. They use it in referring to sculptures like the one you see here, classic antelope-style headdresses that they believe are linked through ritual power to a mythical being who came from the sky to teach their ancestors to farm. I'm sure many of you are familiar with this narrative and the story. They also use the phrase to refer to performers like the one you see here who artfully channel the energy of that mythical being, the Chiwara. They can also use it to refer to a specific person, a champion farmer, somebody that embodies, in this case, the qualities of an outstanding farmer who was able to accomplish more than his peers. Since 1992, I've been involved in an ongoing ethnographic study of the interconnections between these different but related usages. And in the process, I've come to learn a good deal about the central role these various kinds of Chiwara play in the way that local people make a living and how they make that living meaningful. in other presentations and publications, I've documented and analyzed these dynamics really closely with an eye toward appreciating the continuing vitality of the complex in situ in the Malian context, in this rural context on the Mande Plateau. In that work, I argue that Chiwara is a traditionally modern institution, an institution that's dynamic, that's culturally sensitive, and is not an archaic kind of relic, a stand-outside-of-time phenomenon. In my presentation this morning, however, what I want to do is look at a new avenue of research that I'm pursuing. I'm in the process now of examining the role Chiwara play in an arena of cultural production outside the village setting, beyond the millet and sorghum fields of its origin, beyond the Mande Plateau, beyond the Bamana area of Mali. Essentially, what I want to do is a study of Chiwara's power beyond its homeland. I'm in the midst of a large-scale project designed really to map the movement of Chiwara from this agrarian homeland into the wider world, onto the national stage, and the international stage, and the global stage. So the presentation that I'm giving you today is a sketch of that. It's a map that kind of takes us from these rural environments all the way into the kind of global arena. So in 20 minutes, I'm going to be very brief in my comments about all these little points along the way within the map. But what I want to be able to do is signal where this project is going and where Chiwara has gone. And I think from these first slides that I've shown you that reveal the kind of village setting that I'm most familiar with Chiwara in, you'll see some of these slides as we go through now are going to take us well beyond that kind of arena, and the questions that poses for me and for others that are interested in a so-called tradition-modernity split are very interesting, I think. Okay, so in a short period of time, relatively short period of time, I've been able to identify a staggering number of Chiwara manifestations, and I welcome all of you to give me any Chiwara manifestations that you're familiar with. I'm basically trying to build a catalog of all of the Chiwara manifestations that we might know of outside of the context. I'm sure all of you have examples, and I'm happy to catalog them. In a short period of time, I've come up with lots of different utilizations of the form. This is a logo for a French website, a design company. And they're very, very far removed from the arena of farming that the Chiwara is originally connected to. Because my exploration of this process is ongoing and my time today is limited, my presentation will consist of a short mapping exercise. I've elected to highlight a small handful of illustrative cases that reveal how a form that many outsiders see as the so-called traditional African expressive culture, element of traditional culture, has become enmeshed in a series of very so-called modern contexts. Along the way, I will identify what I see as the central issues engendered in these cases and briefly discuss some of the implications of these shifts. In what follows, I explore the Chiwara on the national stage in Mali, within the region, West Africa, in France, and then in the United States. Before moving on, however, I want to thank Professor Ogbeche and Mr. Mabetfo and the Foundation for inviting me to participate in this distinguished forum. As the Bamana say, Aniche Anibara, thank you and I honor your work. It's a pleasure to be here and I appreciate that. So since the 1990s, images of Chiwara have proliferated in and around Bamako. For several days in June 2002, I plied the streets of the city in a rented taxi just to document as many as I could find driving around the city. I thought that would be a kind of a shotgun approach to finding as many images as I could. And I found them everywhere, from this in the city hall to billboards for a particular bar, nightclub, and NGOs as well. And the bustling metropolis is kind of filled with all of these images on that kind of urban national scale. And there are a variety of very kind of modern institutions like City Hall, like a bar restaurant, and like an NGO. The utilization of this traditional image in these contexts is interesting, I think. What can be made of this proliferation? Why is the Chiwara so significant in this kind of struggling to be modern urban context? While my analysis of the phenomenon is fairly preliminary, it's clear that the image carries a great deal of meaning in the urban setting, a different meaning than it carries for rural farmers on the plateau. urban people I spoke to said that the Chiwara stands for important things. They mentioned hard work, history, heritage, honesty. They always spoke with tones of respect and honor when they used the term. Feeling like I was onto something, I began to ask people on the street if they knew of other examples of the Chiwara in the urban mainstream. The examples continued. There's a Chiwara Academy. There's an NGO that makes a pump called the Chiwara. There's a Chiwara for commercial prowess, somebody who's really good at entrepreneurial activities. It's an internet server for Sotelma, the national telephonic system in Mali. It's also a prize for outstanding scientists at ICRISTAT. It's a prize for educational programming. The government gives out a Chiwara prize to people who they think have done tremendous work in Mali, like ATT, the president. Rokia Traore, who many of you probably know, popular singer, has enjoyed much success with her song Chiwara, which one person commented should be the national anthem of Mali, which is interesting. Recently, my request for more manifestations of the Chiwara has led me to a host of new appearances. I'm just going to run through a few of these, and you can kind of locate the imagery and the utilization of the terms on these pages as well. One particularly striking new manifestation is this. This is a Chiwara card. It's a prepaid telephone card in Mali. So you can get your Chiwara card in order to make contact with your people. So, I mean, this is an employment of a traditional form, traditional icon, essentially, in this kind of a context for talking about buying a prepaid Chiwara card. It takes us very far, very quickly, from the fields of the Mande Plateau. Clearly, Malians of various ethnic backgrounds see Chiwara as an icon worthy of attention. The champion farmer becomes the champion politician, the champion business leader, the champion internet server, and now the champion phone card. Chiwara imagery is well established throughout the wider West African region in contexts that are relatively little connection to the Mande cultural or agricultural experience. This slide from Senegal, Chakantana Jop University. The Chiwara form is found in the seal here. And interestingly, in a kind of an interesting bit of bricolage, the image is blended with the Latin motto, Lux mea lex, light is my law. It's an interesting kind of connection from the ground up, from Chiwara to their, to the logo here. It's also, as we've heard about, the Institute Fundamental d'Afrique Noire celebrates the Chiwara tradition as part of its region's common patrimony. Also, the West Africa Museum Project, whose mission is the preservation and study of the region's material heritage, uses the Chiwara as its logo. It's kind of small up here in this particular slide. Interestingly, the best-known regional manifestation comes from the sky, like the mythic Chiwara itself. Probably you know where I'm going with this. Throughout its existence, the now-defunct Air Afrique used a stylized version of the Chiwara antelope as its official logo. In doing so, it helped elevate a symbol with a rich and deeply localized profile to international status. During its heyday, the airline had routes across Africa into Europe and the Americas. On a daily basis, then, Chiwara traveled the world, seeing and being seen by thousands of people, the vast majority of whom knew nothing of the meaningful world of origin. Instead, they saw and understood the form as an icon of Africa in a general sense. So moving on to France. Early French colonial officers and administrators took interest in the antelope form for sure. Captain Archenard, known as the so-called conqueror of the French Sudan, is said to have been one of the first Europeans to send an antelope headdress home for display. Indeed, one of his acquisitions, shown here, was used to help launch the Musée d'Ethnographie de Trocadéro in Paris in the 1880s. Archenard's original act of Chiwara promotion has magnified in French culture for more than a century now. As numerous art historians have shown, various kinds of African sculpture displayed at cultural sites like the Trocadéro played an important role in the emergence of some of Western modern art's most revered figures. Of course, Pablo Picasso is a celebrated example of this, which you're all familiar with. However, it's also interesting to note that the Chiwara form was something that he took interest in as well about the same time. This is Picasso's Two Antelopes, 1907, and the antelope headdress, Chiwara headdress, Picasso in his studio. In the mid-1920s, we also know, through the work of art historians, about the connection between the French stage and the production, the creation of the world, which is shown here. This is a kind of a progression. If you look at Lager's study of the Bauman antelope for this production, the creation of the world, the source of that sketch, and then the ultimate manifestation in the costume that was used in the production itself. It's the early part of the 20th century. These connections are pretty tight. Chiwara is clearly getting around at the beginning of the 20th century. Just last year, the Musée de Quai Branly gave the Chiwara its own full-scale exhibition. Clearly, from the late 19th century to the early 21st century, thousands, if not millions, of museum goers and culture seekers in France have seen the Chiwara and have been seen by them. In the process, the form has informed and shaped perceptions of Africa and Africans for generations of modern, so-called modern Westerners. However, the reach of Chiwara goes well beyond high culture in France, so-called high culture. In my research, I have discovered Chiwara in an amazing realm of contemporary pop culture. The French musician artist known as Qual has embraced the Bamana world in Mali, and its Chiwara tradition in profound ways, profound and deeply intriguing ways. Qual took part in the famous Festival of the Desert in northern Mali that some of you may be familiar with in 2002, and was impressed with the local musicians and the artists he met and with the overall culture of Mali. This led him to an ongoing engagement with a series of Malian artists, notably Tiken Ja Fakoli, and to a wider engagement with the challenges of life in Mali. Upon his return to France, Qual recorded Mogoya, Humanity, in Bamana. According to Qual's MySpace page, a quote from his MySpace page here, it's maybe the only citation to a MySpace page that you'll see all day, I guess. Okay. At the time, introspective and open to the world, this opus is conceived as a voyage in which the cultures of various countries are engaged in a fascinating dialogue. Not less than 12 languages and 28 musicians from India to Andalusia are joined together on this recording. The release has three Bamana titles on it, all of which are sung by Qual in the Bamana language. The lead track on this release is called Chiwara. In the song, Qual draws on the Chiwara complex to speak to the Malian people, in a sense, to praise them, to motivate them to achieve their highest good. A few examples from the lyrics reveal his grasp of tradition and its potential to honor and inspire people. So I'm just going to kind of be Qual for a few minutes here. I actually have a video that I want to show where he sings, but I want to go through a few of the lyrics just quickly. Okay, so Qual says, Chiwara, Chiwara, ever since Kurukan Fuga, this Jamana is being built with one goal. Since the rise of the reign of Sunjata, since the rise of the lion, you have been rising, Mali, ever since the rise of Sunjata. You have been rising with power. You have been rising with dignity. You have been rising with a great ideal. And then later in the song, he says, you must remember that you are the stars of Africa. You must remember that you are the torchbearers of Africa. It is a well-known fact that power, governance, originates here. All great men know this history. All Africa knows this history. The entire world knows this history. All Euro-Americans know this history. Do not be fearful of anything. Stay bold and do not regret anything. Praise for your happiness. A chorus of Chiwara, Chiwara goes through the background of this whole song. The Chiwara imagery goes beyond the lyrics also. And if we can see, I'm going to try to show this little video clip. It's maybe a little problematic with the technology, but we're going to try to see if we can get it to run. So if you bear with me here, I'm just going to escape here for a second and minimize this if I can. And then see if this works. If there's anybody here who the technology person is, let's see if we can just run. Here it comes. I don't know if we can just get this screen. Yeah.
I think in the interest of time, we'll just kind of give you a sense of what he's up to there. And I want to talk a little bit more about some of the issues that this raises. So I'm just going to pause it here. We can watch it later if anybody's around and wants to see that. It's pretty interesting. Okay, an interesting twist, actually, if you think about Qual and what he's up to. Here he is acting as a self-appointed griot to the contemporary Malian people. In a sense, he's returning Chiwara to Mali in the context of a motivational speech. If you've listened to some of the words that I read from his lyrics, he's basically talking to the Malian people about rising up and remembering their history and things like this. In a weird twist, he's kind of returning what Arshnard took before, you know, 100 years ago. He's using Chiwara now to speak back to the Malian people in the Bamana language to talk about their heritage and talk about their capacities. There's so much more to explore with Qual, but we're not going to stay with him now. We're going to move on to the U.S. context and talk just briefly about the U.S. representations of Chiwara before I close up. Like their counterparts in France, American audiences obviously have been interested in the Chiwara form, albeit for a somewhat shorter time. While examples of Chiwara have been documented in the U.S. beginning in the early part of the 20th century, it really wasn't until the 30s and 40s that museums and private collectors began to add antelope headdresses to their holdings in growing numbers. By mid-century, prominent U.S. art collectors such as Nelson Rockefeller had established traditional, so-called traditional African art, as a significant component of their celebrated collections, opening the way for a dramatic expansion of attention to African material culture. Chiwara has been an integral part of that expansion. This is a book that has the plate, Nelson Rockefeller's library plate, which interestingly was chosen to Chiwara form for this. As many of you probably know, in 2004, Alicia Lagama organized a symposium and exhibit called Genesis, a pathbreaking exhibition on African objects at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Due in part to its prized status among collectors, the Chiwara tradition was the centerpiece of the show, as shown here. And also, as probably many of you know, the sales of Chiwara headdresses continue to be very brisk. This one sold at $78,000. Recently. Clearly, the Chiwara form continues to be exalted in the elite U.S. art world context to play a role in the construction, ultimately, of a so-called worldly consumer of African expressive culture. As in France, the Chiwara has had a dynamic life outside the museum world as well. In particular, the African-American community has embraced and nurtured a close relationship with the Chiwara form. Lorenzo Pace's 300-ton granite structure, Triumph of Spirit in New York City, shows this connection very clearly. And you can just briefly look at the text here that talks about the connection between Pace's work and the honoring of the slaves who were buried at the African burial ground in New York City, and his inspiration for that coming from the Chiwara form. There are various expressions of this in popular culture, and some of it in more profound places as well. This is an interesting one. I think the text is illustrative of some issues as well. Cassandra strikes a pose at the museum next to a Chiwara, a stylized antelope mark from the Dogon tribe of Mali that represents a mythical being who taught man to farm. It's an interesting kind of telling of what this object is and what its sensitivity is to communities that might be interested in purchasing this. So I'm going to briefly just go through a few examples like this to show you where it turns up. Okay. This is a quilt by Roland Freeman. Incorporates the Chiwara form in support of a Kwanzaa celebration. This is a very common place to find Chiwara, actually, within the context of Kwanzaa celebrations. And Kwanzaa expressive culture associated with that. The dance troupe also in the dance theater carries
The late African-American dancer and choreographer Charles Moore is well known for integrating so-called traditional African dances into his troupe's repertoire, in the process establishing his place in the realm of so-called modern African-American dance. He's credited with bringing the Chiwara form to the American stage in the 1980s. The dance theater that carries his name still performs the Chiwara headdress under the direction of his widow, Ella Thompson Moore. Last example, Gene Lacy used the Chiwara image and drew on its storyline for inclusion in a dramatic set of stained glass windows completed for the St. Luke United Methodist Church in Dallas. As you can see right down here, the Chiwara form. As these select examples illustrate, members of the African American community have engaged and employed the Chiwara in their efforts to forge meaningful connections to what they see as themes from their generalized African heritage. In this context, traditional Chiwara form has been integrated into the formulation of a modern diasporic identity. So, people on the Mande Plateau tell me that the power of their Chiwara is awesome. They tell me that their Chiwara have the capacity to influence and affect the world around them in profoundly important ways. The man pictured here, a distinguished Chiwara performer, has taught me a great deal about the power of Chiwara in his world, and in the process has put me in a unique position to explore its power beyond his community. My mapping of the journey of Chiwara into the world beyond the fields of rural Mali would surely amaze this man and the people who are affiliated with that form in the context that I'm most familiar with. Clearly, what some see as a quintessentially traditional phenomenon has been and continues to be employed in the construction of very different kinds of so-called modern identities and realities, ones where farming and the indigenous ritual of the order I've experienced on the Mande Plateau are quite far removed. As I've shown in this presentation, people who are far removed from the day-to-day realities of agrarian ways of life recognize the significance of the imagery and the power of Chiwara, and through their actions and representations, they use it to bring meaning to new concerns and new activities. Indeed, this is just what their traditionally modern rural counterparts do. In both contexts, then, the power of Chiwara is truly awesome. Thank you.
You know, the issue that comes up now is the issue of whether or not this state is exceptionally weak, particularly given what's happening in France now in terms of how the state is typically constructed and, you know, the idea of who gets, in a sense, incorporated into the state. So in Senegal today, the kind of vital forms really seem to be things that often refer to the United States, like rap idioms or idioms that are very much focused on another kind of referent other than France. And I'm wondering, in the work that you've looked at, whether you see this kind of opposition going on. On the one hand, you know, the idea of the post-colonial state related to France on the one hand, and the fact that in recent past, people could get good jobs by being hired in the civil service. That's no longer the case in Senegal. Instead, people are looking for business opportunities, looking for ways in which to be connected with the U.S. Particularly. And I'm wondering, through the artwork, whether you see that this kind of link to the U.S., to more potent kinds of idioms are present in the work. So, sorry for that convoluted question.
Yeah, no, I understand, and absolutely. One of the persistent criticisms, you know, for a good 30 years, you know, has been the inefficacy or inefficiency of the Senegalese state to really address what's going on by the majority of the residents in Dakar in Senegal. And the way I think they conceptualize what constitutes art is one of the is representative of the limitations of their approach to it. And that's why this museum, the Ecopole, was established, because it accommodates a more much more diverse visual culture that you see throughout the city in murals and in these more more dynamic constructions and making do with whatever materials are available, and there isn't a place for that in the state exhibition and collecting structure at all, and that continues to be the case. And the Ecopol, too, has such an economic orientation, and it's very grassroots-oriented. And so there's this matrix of creativity in terms of economy, aesthetics, politics, social, civic education, everything, that kind of comes together, whereas in the state, they're relatively disengaged. And so I think it speaks to what I think you're talking about, how there's the state adheres to this certain, you know, Francophile tradition of cultural policy that doesn't seem to function very well in practice, whereas this is an institution that takes practice as its point of departure rather than concept. Does that speak at all to what you were getting at?
Yeah. I mean, I guess I agree with what you're saying, and I'm wondering, the use of recycled material, for example,
whether or not there is a reference, in a sense, rethinking what the point of reference is. Mm-hmm. That's the...
Yeah.
I mean, whether in the work itself that you've looked at,
absolutely,
whether you see that.
In other presentations, I've brought in more examples of the popular visual culture, Indicar, which is linked to that use of very global, or the materials show a global reference. For example, there's one image I did some work with in these mechanics yards where they work on the vehicles that sport very, very dynamic decoration and painting. And the time I was there in like 97, 98, a lot of them were painting Air Medina with a Nike swoosh. And so that's a very deliberate reference to something that's kind of conceptualized as American in the abstracted sense ideal. And I don't see it as kind of monopoly of Nike at all, really. I see it as kind of choosing an emblem for a certain aspiration for, you know, the trajectory an individual of modest means can take to achieve something in their dreams. And so, there's this popular imagery that's recognizable to diverse publics, but I think is understood by the different people in very different ways. But looking at that imagery is a way of kind of looking at what those relationships are, and the state doesn't really permit those to exist.
Any other questions? Yes, please.
Stephen, I enjoyed your presentation. Enjoyed both presentations. I was particularly struck by what I think of as a kind of tiki-ization of the Chiwara, and it's the Chiwara and the Asante Akuaba that have become international symbols of Africa and African art. There have been quite a few studies of the Hawaiian tiki. I don't know if you have drawn upon those in your own analyses, but I think they could be useful to you. And Doran Ross, as you may know, has done a little mini study of the tikiization of the Akuaba form in Elizabeth Cameron's Isn't He She a Doll? The UCLA Fowler publication. But it's a wonderful avenue of research, and you've uncovered a lot of good stuff, and I'm sure it will continue to proliferate. In fact, as you may know, an American-African sculptor by the name of Kofi Cole has taken this as his own logo.
Oh, really? Okay, great. Thank you. Yeah, that's great.
Any other questions or comments from the audience? Well, then I have something. I'm kind of... Okay, Luis, go ahead. Sylvester.
My question is in reference to the artistic production of the Chiwara. Has that changed locally as a result of this international fame? Clearly, the artist is now seeing himself part of a global community. And I'm wondering how that sort of insight and this attention has sort of changed artistic production. And has that shaped, has it come, maintained its traditional aspects, or has it taken on a sort of this idea of a commodity? Are we seeing market saturation on a local level?
Mm-hmm. It's a great question, and it's a little bit of both, I think, depending on the particular output, where the sculpture is headed. You know, if the, like the sculptures that you saw in the first few slides were produced kind of in a local setting, a village setting, by somebody who was a resident in that area for people on commission in that area. But lots and lots, as you're probably well aware, lots of Chiwara get produced in big workshops all over Africa, actually. You know, in Mali, for sure, in big workshops, but in other places, in Dakar and other places as well. So there's actually kind of simultaneously different kinds of production systems for different kinds of outlets. So I think your question points to the idea that there could be a feedback system coming into the kind of more workshop settings, the more commodified workshop settings. The blacksmith carvers that I'm familiar with on the Mande Plateau are pretty localized in their production and their kind of inputs that are coming into their creativity, and they're not necessarily tuned into that kind of a global manifestations, like some of the conversations that I can see having now with some of these images and showing Chiwara in these various places to people in the localized setting will create some interesting debate and discussion, I'm sure. People in the capital city of Bamako and other places in Dakar are definitely well aware of the interest in the form, and that's been going on for over 100 years, really. As soon as people started collecting that, workshops were said to have been constructed in order, not just Chiwara, but lots of forms to produce them for the export market or for collectors in the region, too. So I think both, actually. The kind of the images that I showed at the outset of those Chiwaras in context, those don't have the same kind of feedback. The system hasn't reached that kind of a spot, but definitely in the urban commodified region, for sure.
Yes, please.
Just to feed off of that question, how have you brought Chiwara home, and have you integrated that into your research techniques?
Interesting that last slide, if we put up the last slide with that Chiwara performer who was looking at the Chiwara headdress that was being made, I actually commissioned a pair of headdresses myself to bring home to utilize in my teaching and to have in my office and things like this. It's like the only African sculpture that I have, actually, and the blacksmith who made that headdress, do you remember the image of the guy holding it and looking at it? It's just being produced by the carver, and the Chiwara performer is checking it out to see what, you know, the content of it is, how does it look. And an interesting part of that dynamic is that when the blacksmith agreed to carve them for me, he agreed to carve them for me a little smaller than they would be if they were going to be used on somebody's head. I wanted to be able to stick them in my bag to bring home. So they were smaller by command from me, who was commissioning the work. And also, he told me that they weren't dangerous, which is really important. Dangerous in the sense of power that might be associated with something that's deeply connected to people's ritual and religious worlds. He made it very clear that these headdresses were not going to be kind of blessed, essentially, with energy that could potentially be harmful to me as somebody who doesn't understand completely the form and its power. So he said, you can definitely take these home. You can show them to people in your class. You can do whatever you want with them. They don't have any bossy, no power, no particular amulets associated with them. So they are in my office, and they are safe, and they do go to class every once in a while. And they don't necessarily harm anybody.
Took me way too literally, but that was so interesting.
Okay. Sorry.
I actually meant how does your global research mm-hmm. affect your research when you are in workshops with local carvers? Do you incorporate that into your dialogue, what you found of Chiwara?
Yeah, I began to do that, and in part of the discussions that I had with, like in that 2002 round of field work that I did in the city, talking to local people in the village setting about the things that I found in the city, talking to them about that is one of the most eye-opening kind of conversations that I've had in years of research. You know, people thinking about kind of, we would talk about it as appropriation and kind of loss of something that's profoundly important to people being kind of utilized in the capital city by people who can't farm, is the way that they would put it. They can't take care of themselves. They don't know anything about Chiwara that we have. our chiwara help us farm, and the chiwara that other people have are just kind of empty. They're white chiwara, not white in the sense of skin color white, but kind of empty chiwara. And they talk about it as kind of a theft, almost, that people are using these symbols way beyond. And then the conversations that I've had haven't had the dimensions of, you know, era freak and all of the other kind of elements that I've shown. But definitely people in the local setting are kind of turned off by the utilizations of it in other kinds of places.
Any other questions from the audience?
Maybe I should say something about that, if you don't mind.
Sure.
I think that's quite a very important issue about ownership of, you know, cultural knowledge and intellectual property, which for me is really where the work now needs to be, you know, to be done, to proceed. You know, who owns the knowledge of chiwara, and why would it be so easily accessible for exploitation without any without any remuneration to the producers of the form, for which it still remains a very important cultural object. Mm-hmm. I wanted to also point out on the issue of Drew Thompson's question about globalization of chiwara, that Mande culture has been globalized since the 12th century, which would, you know, throw quite a very big wrench into that idea that chiwara just emerges. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of the things that's been picked up in the studies of African populations in the Americas is among the early identifiable forms that we've been able to at least track, chiwaras make an appearance in some manner, if not in the actual form of the object, but in the practices of the knowledge system that the chiwara supports, you know, which was used in places like Haiti, Cuba, and then the southern United States.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.